I'm Shannon Griffin, and this is Chatterbox. In the second of four episodes of my interview with Heather Mills, I delve further into her thoughts on the UK food industry, her views on UK politics, and I find out about her early modelling career and subsequent near-fatal accident, which brought her to public prominence.
Do you think that we've got a nutritional crisis in this country at a time when, relatively speaking, I know that we've had a cost of living crisis over the last couple of years, but relatively speaking, food has never been more available or cheaper. We have a society that is increasingly obese, but probably malnourished, which is a complete contradiction.
It's a bit like we were talking about the mental health thing about people getting self-absorbed. The problem is, and the solution is, so let's see where the problem is. The problem is the excuses made. Oh, I feel a bit dizzy, my blood sugar, let's shove it full of more white pasta and white bread. Well, I can't afford healthy food, when actually I've done the whole P&L analysis on it, and you save thousands of pounds by eating healthy food. I mean, I created the first vegan McDonald's burger back in 2003, unfortunately, because of Murdoch and the newspapers. It got delayed for many, many years before it went in to help save the environment. But what you do is you do stage one, stage two, stage three, depending where you are in the sector. So the solution is replace like for like. So all processed foods are not good for you, but vegan processed foods, and the word processed just means anything that's, let's say a soy burger is made from edamame and it's made into a burger. That is a process. So people get confused, the misinformation. You save 99% land, you're saving the planet, the animals, and most importantly for you selfishly, you are helping your health. Once you do that, and I've done this on millions of people around the world, having, you know, manufactured vegan food for 30 years to 24 countries, then you move to stage two because your taste buds change, your metabolism changes, and suddenly you don't want those alternate meat, fish, and dairy substitutes. You're suddenly introduced to vegetables. I grew vegetables on the rooftop of all of the Bronx area, and I opened up free cafes next to McDonald's, and basically the pound that they were allocated for their food a day they saved, and all the kids went there. 3 months later, type 2 diabetes gone. 6 months later, down to 2 insulin injections a day. Brain function up 49%. We did all this with Cornell University. Professor Colin Campbell did a study for 30 years. All the science is there, all of it's proven, but for some reason, and maybe it's the lobbyists, which don't make any sense because the dairy farms making the milk are paid for by the taxpayer. Now, we want the farmers to continue to make a living and operate, so we've done loads of conversions to oats. So we can feed 500 more people from making products from oats than we can from one cow. So it's all so easy and solvable, but the government are just like walruses. I mean, half of them, you just look at them and they don't look healthy at all. So how can they be the people that make, how can you not have a mega healthy health secretary?
It's astonishing, isn't it? When one of our health secretaries was announced and she's no longer in that position, I was quite astonished. I would have thought like you that it would be somebody who at least on the outside looked as though they were the right kind of body weight and constitution and looked healthy, but I was astonished.
Body weight's not necessarily relevant because I know really healthy people that are what people would perceive a few kilos over, but that's very genetic as well. And then other people that are really skinny who are really, really unhealthy and live off cigarettes and champagne. So I don't really go on how someone looks on their body size. But you can tell when someone's healthy because of the whites of their eyes, because that's very connected to the gut. So I always look when health secretary is speaking on television. And when I see, because even if you don't get much sleep like me, when your gut's healthy, then your eyes are still not totally bloodshot from 5 gin and tonics in the Houses of Parliament bar. Mm-hmm. There's so many solutions, and I go in Parliament a lot and talk to them about these solutions, and they move like snails. Yeah. So for me, there needs to be a revolution in England. There needs to be a big turnaround. We need to pay good people real money to run the country, because we're just getting the leftovers, because the really potentially good economists and leaders, some of them are so wealthy they'll do it for nothing. Others are conflicted between whether they're going to run a bank or run the country, and there's a massive gap. So for me, I think politicians, good ones, should be paid more. So we attract, just like businesses do, it should be run like a business. And it is running our country, and it will actually save billions. But all the mistakes we've made, like Brexit, has destroyed the export of manufacturing, jobs, everything. We've got a really weak government that are not holding the utility companies to ransom to say, what the hell are you doing? You've got an incredible amount of money in excess storage, yet Auntie Joan down the road is sitting there freezing because she's conscientious. She's not going to be able to pay her heating bill. I mean, that is disgusting. In Boston, where I've just bought a recent factory, next door neighbor, the farmer, is feeding 1,400 children a week because the schools don't have a cooker. I mean, this is in England. I also did a big donation to a charity when I funded a concert at Alexander Palace, because the schools couldn't afford a computer or pens and pencils. We're in England.
That is astonishing. It must be so dispiriting when you see that kind of thing. Those basic things, we're getting it so wrong.
So wrong. It's unbelievable. And it's the layman on the street like me and others that have to go in and fix it. Yet we are paying taxes, and I pay a lot of taxes, and so do all my employees. We are paying taxes to a government that insisted everyone got out of Europe to save money, and the economy couldn't be worse. It couldn't be in a worse situation. No. What are they doing with that money that we're supposedly saving?
I'm wondering whether part of the problem is that a lot of councillors and politicians are in it as a career option, and all they're worried about is becoming re-elected. So it's not worth investing in anything long term, because what they have to do is try and convince the public and the voters that they're worth electing for the next round. So it's all very short term, it seems to me.
If they actually did something in the first round, which is, it's not always that easy. We need to change legislation that the people in the power actually have some power. We don't want like a free reign, but we want change to happen, and it has to happen, and red tape to be cut. You know, when there's an emergency situation, it shouldn't be, let's look at the 1735 Legislation Act, even though we live in 2023. I mean, I've represented myself in court a number of times, and just people turning up in wigs, I mean, come on, and putting on white wigs and standing there going, Your Honour, I think blah, 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 and keep referring back to 1 million-year-old legislation. We need things reset and renewed for the times that we're living in now, not as an example from 200 years ago. And that is what is stilting any growth in the UK. All of the box ticking instead of just, and my ethos has always been smash down the walls, get it done, bum, bum, bum. And I remember when I worked in the war in the former Yugoslavia, and they said, oh, we've just got so many landmines. We've got so many this. I said, well, why don't we do this, 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 that? Oh, no, we've tried for years and this. And I just don't see how there's a problem. So I'll go to that person, you do that. You're in charge of Vietnam. You're Afghanistan. You're this. Let's split up the competition and the mine clearing. Put you separately. Let's do this. Boom. Suddenly we've cleared 27 million square meters of land within 3-4 years. We fitted up 400,000 people with artificial limbs. It's not that complicated, because a lot of people care. And I tell you what, it's not the University of Cambridge and Oxford every time. It's the University of Life. And common sense is the biggest thing that is lacking in today's world. You know, parents are just working 24/7, shoving their kids in front of computers to just have a minute's breather. Not monitoring what they're watching on the computer, becoming antisocial, So it's like a Harry Enfield skit where they won't even talk to their parents, not actually saying, what can I do with my child to keep us connected in preparation of that hormonal change that is hell to deal with? You know, my kid, I said, let's go to the theatre. And that became our regular thing to stay connected, to have something to talk about, knowing this hormonal madness goes on. We're just so busy running around like busy fools and not actually always resolving something.
Heather, you make no secret of the fact that you had a very difficult childhood, but I was astonished to read that you ran away to the circus.
Yeah. So my mum left when I was 9. She'd lost her leg at the same age as me, bizarrely, and they reattached it.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously didn't lose my leg until years later, but we were both technically 25.
Yeah.
And she then met a man called Charles Stapley, who was apparently the antique dealer in Crossroads and the understudy to Professor Higgins in My Fair Lady, Rex Harrison. She fell in love with him, charming, dashing, slightly older man, and left us with my dad, who was pretty abusive, to carry on with his Wagner madness. So I, when he went to prison, ended up in London, lived with her a few months, and then left and went on the streets,
mm-hmm.
And then got my first job. So when I was with my mum, I didn't get on with her boyfriend at all. He'd been married 3 times before. He didn't want children there. So I was always, and my sister left to have dinner in our bedrooms. We weren't allowed to join them for dinner in the room. And I got friendly with a traveling fair called Freddie Gray's Fair on Clapham Common. And I thought, oh, I'm going to ask if I can have a job. And I pretended I was older because I used to wear a lot of makeup because I had really bad acne. So I used to just plaster my face with Leichner theatre makeup. Not knowing I was actually allergic to dairy. So if anyone's got hormonal kids with acne, or just wipe out dairy for 3 months and 90% of you, it will be eliminated. There'll be 10% that have it for different reasons, but 90% of the reason of acne is dairy. So I was very insecure with all that acne when I was younger. And one of the guys at the fair became like an older brother to me. And said, okay, you can work here. So I worked on the Walser Ride, and I used to travel literally around South London. So it would go from Clapham south to Balham to Tooting, Beck, over to Morden, Streatham, and do that sort of circle, which at that age felt miles from the other. And then I found him sadly dead from a drugs overdose and had to run away because I was underage.
How old were you at that point?
I was 14.
Right.
And 14 and a half. And then, and that's when I had to run away. And I was just sofa sleeping on different friends' sofas. Jill and Tony, shout out to them, who were amazing, helping me out. And also George and Sylvia and Julia in Newcastle. In fact, Julia, my best mate in Newcastle, I'm going to see this weekend. And we're doing a Frank Sinatra tribute party for George's 87th. And
how
he's
lovely.
Been in that hospital 4 times this year, and we can't believe he's still going. So I managed to get him up on his Zimmer frame last year to do a bit of a dance to That's Life.
Fabulous. Well, I hope you have a great time at that party. It's a wonderful thing to do. So you've had a very disrupted childhood, and I guess running away to the circus and then finding yourself homeless underneath the arches in Waterloo. And then you got into modelling at a fairly young age as well. Tell me about your experience and how that changed you from that point forward.
Well, that was accidental, because I never thought, being a young acne teenager, that I could be a model. Having big boobs was not fashionable back then. It was very sort of stick model fashion until the industry woke up and realised that wasn't healthy. Hopefully they won't go back there again.
Yeah.
But my boyfriend at the time, who was my second ever boyfriend, sent a picture into the Daily Mirror Dream Girl competition in a swimsuit. And apparently I won it to go in the newspaper, and I knew nothing about it. And the telephone rang, and in those days there were no mobile phones.
Mm.
It was in the 80s. They said, you've won to be in the newspaper, the Mirror Dream Girl competition. I was like, well, I haven't entered. What are you talking about? And because I already had businesses and things, I had no interest whatsoever. And I said, and he said, no, but, you know, let us tell you what it's about. You get to travel the world and this and that. And I didn't hear anything else other than travel the world. And all that went off in my head was, interesting. So they'd pay me to travel the world to do a couple of hours modeling. I could find other products to import into the UK and start running the business and just utilize the free travel just to do a couple of hours work. So while a lot of the girls were sitting there having a coffee and smoking cigarettes, I was going to the markets, working out what products we didn't have in the UK. And that's how I ended up setting up my import-export business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up getting involved in modeling. And I was modeling for a very short time, but it seemed to become the headline that sat with me since I lost my leg. I wasn't a successful model. I was a very average model. I basically had a few contracts, but I was, 5'7½" and you always had to be 5'8". I was always too many kilos over that I should have been for those days because I love my food. And I was willing to exercise, but I didn't want to compromise on my food. So I was always being told off by the agent. And then I saw some dark sides of modeling. Because I was an extreme anti-drugs person to the degree that it drove some of my friends who liked the occasional pop mad, because I was like, it's going to kill you. Because my friend had died in the fair. I thought all drugs are going to kill everybody and they're terrible. My mum was an acupuncturist and psychologist and a homeopath at the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital. So when she left my dad, she studied and did that. So she was very anti-drugs and everything natural. So I was brought up with no drugs. I saw all these drugs and all this manipulation and models not being treated and paid properly and being able to act professionally. So I thought, I think I'll set up a model agency. So I was only about 19 and I set up the first Excel model agency in St. Vincent Street off Marylebone High Street, which then expanded to Bulstrode Street and then down to Kingly Street in the 80s. And I paid the models every week. And the way that I managed to do that was borrow it from the bank and pay the small interest rate and then just charge that to the client on top within the rate. So it meant models were paid every week. They could be professional. They didn't have to go and work night shifts and turn up exhausted for shoots. And we became really, really successful. If a customer asked for a 5'10" brunette with brown eyes, that's what we sent. But the other model agencies sent everybody on the books and wasted their time. So in the end, they would only come to us and a couple of other agencies, Dorothy Perkins and all of those Burton Group companies. And then I had that for a few years and then eventually got married, 21, thinking I'm old. Goodness. I better settle down.
You're old at 21. Mind you, the amount of experience you'd had up until that time.
That's that. I've got younger as I've got older in my head because I was such an old woman back then because my mum had left. I always had to be the mother of everything. Yeah. I realise now, reflecting. And I just said, okay, great. So I sold the agency, got married. Basically ended up having 4 miscarriages and 2 ectopic pregnancies. Oh. And then I was told I couldn't have kids. And I had a brilliant, brilliant gynecologist called Mr. Yehudi Gordon, who was at the Garden Clinic in Hendon. And they wanted to take my tubes out after the ectopic first pregnancy. And I said, I don't want that to happen. Can't I just see if it fixes itself? Because the body's amazing. Surely it heals. And they were like, why is she asking all these questions? We always take it out as a risk. And I said, well, I've looked, and if you monitor the HCG levels and they go down, then it's going to resolve itself. But if they go up, then if I carry my medical things around, you can just rush me in and take it out then. But it gives me a chance that in the future I could have a small chance of having a child. And they didn't want to know. They thought it was nuts. So someone introduced me to Yehudi Gordon. He said, that's a really good idea. It's not something we've tested. But if you want to be the tester, it's on your head and at your risk. And I was, and that was in November of 90, and it resolved itself. And then I had another one in the February of 91. And I didn't, by that time, have any relationship with my husband because he had no interest and not supportive. But I got on really well with his ex-wife because we would share the kids, and I wasn't involved in the separation of their divorce. They split up years before. So she invited me skiing to the former Yugoslavia, and I never skied in my life because you had to have money to ski as a kid. And when I was out there, I discovered I had the second ectopic pregnancy, and I rang Yehudi and said, what do I do? He said, well, make sure you need a hospital, but I think your body's going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it did. And then I went back and they tested my tubes and they said, I'm sorry, but you won't be able to have kids because the scar tissue is really bad, but you have kept your tubes. And I was like, okay, I'll come to terms with that. Maybe if I meet someone in the future, we'll adopt. And then when I got married the second time, 12 years later, they basically, my ex-husband said, oh, I make great kids. We should have kids. I said, I can't have kids. And you've got plenty of kids. So we'll just not go down that track. 3 years into the marriage, I was pregnant. And Yehudi Gordon said, how on earth has this happened? I had a massive 11-pound baby coming in this tiny vegan body. And I said, it's called the vegan grow bag. And I had metal plates in my pelvis because in the middle of that, I'd lost my leg after coming back from the war and crushed my pelvis. So the metal plates holding my hips together and my pubic symphysis could only take a baby up to 7 pounds, and then it broke. So I had to be on crutches and in a wheelchair for the last couple of months. But when the baby came out, Yehudi said, can I bring some specialists in? Because we don't understand how you've got pregnant and had a baby with all that scar tissue, because they put the dye up and it was completely blocked. And they went back in and they said, this can't be the same tubes. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, they're clear. There's no scar tissue. He said, they're completely healed. You can have more babies, but look at the results. Look at them. What have you done? And I said, nothing. And then my ex turned around and said, well, you did turn vegan within 2 years, and you've been like that for 15 years, so maybe you've healed your body. And of course, even I thought that was too far-fetched. But now, with the science that I've seen on what is healable, I think everything is possible.
My thanks to Heather Mills. Join me in the third episode of my 4-part Chatterbox series, where I find out why she became vegan, her experience of being in hospital, and her approach to dealing with challenges and adversity. To listen to more episodes or find links to all of our programmes and videos, visit hospitalradiomedway.co.uk. I'm Shannon Griffin, and you've been listening to Chatterbox.